Ladies and gentlemen, it was a cold-blooded, premeditated murder.
Everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Red and Buried podcast. I'm Frankie, and I'm delighted to be joined by the legend that is Jane Casey. Hi, Jane.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
I am so excited to have you here because, truth be told, Jane, every time we have an author on, we ask, you know, book recommendations, what people are reading, what they like. And I would say you are the most read author by our authors that we've had on this podcast.
Wow, what a lovely thing to hear.
Well, no, it's not down to me. It's the authors. You know, we ask what they've been reading, what was the last book they read and loved. And you have been said definitely more than any other author that they've said. So there you go.
Well, I think that might be just because I am prolific. There's always a proof floating around. But that's really lovely to hear.
No, it's always joined up with Jane Casey and It's Amazing is always the hand-in-hand compliment that it goes with it. So it's not just because you have a lot of books, or you do have an impressive catalogue, because they're good books as well. So there you go. Well, before we get into the chat, because I have lots of things to ask you and very curious about a few things, I've got a little bio that I've written about you. I hope it's all accurate. I've taken it from various internet sources, but please do tell me if I've got anything horribly wrong.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Red pen at the ready. Okay, here we go. Jane Casey was born and brought up in Dublin. A former editor, she has written 12 crime novels for adults and 3 for teenagers. Her books have been international bestsellers, critically acclaimed for their realism and accuracy. The Maeve Carrigan series, sorry, I should have checked that before. I've only ever read it. I've never said it out loud before.
It's Kerrigan. Yeah.
Perfect. Okay, cool. Thanks. Sorry about that. The Maeve Carrigan series has been nominated for many awards. In 2015, Jane won the Mary Higgin Clark Award for The Stranger You Know and Irish Crime Novel of the Year for After the Fire. In 2019, Cruel Acts was chosen as Irish Crime Novel of the Year at the Irish Book Awards and was a Sunday Times bestseller. The Killing Kind was a Richard and Judy Book Club pick in 2021 and has been adapted for television by 11th Hour and Paramount Plus. Her latest book in her Maeve Carrigan series is A Stranger in the Family, which is out on the 14th of March. Every mother's worst nightmare. When 9-year-old Rosalie Marshall vanished from her bed one summer night, her disappearance tore her family apart. Now, 16 years later, her mother Helena is found dead, her husband by her side. It looks like a straightforward murder-suicide, but DS Maeve Carrigan and DI Josh Derwent soon discover nothing about this case is straightforward. The Marshalls have been keeping secrets, and they're not alone. Josh has been holding something back too, something that could change everything for Maeve. But one person is prepared to kill to hide the truth. Until Maeve finds out what happens to Rosalie, no one will be safe. Oh, that's too exciting stuff. Outside of writing, Jane lives in Southwest London with her husband, who is a criminal barrister, their 2 children, a gorgeous dog named Rory, and a very noisy cat that I learned about this evening. As well as being a very talented and successful writer, she's also very kind and an encouraging voice in the crime writing community.
Oh, well, all of that is completely accurate, especially the last part.
I agree.
Lovely. Everyone knows that.
It's true. As I say, you know, you are a beloved writer, not only by readers, but within the crime writing community.
Well, you know, the crime writing community is so lovely and so warm.
Yes.
I think people don't realize quite how friendly we all are and how welcoming. And really, it's the nicest bit of publishing, I think. Everybody is really supportive. And I suppose I've been around for quite a while now. So I've kind of met loads of people. I've been on panels with people. I've helped them when they were drunk and left their bag. You know, there's all these things that happen to crime writers at festivals. And I seem to have been there for a lot of them.
Well, from my experience, you know, doing this podcast for a few years now and kind of entering the crime writing world is how amazingly lovely and kind everyone is. And Harrogate and places like that, it's just no ego. Everybody is just super friendly and warm and welcoming to each other and not competitive in any way, which I think is amazing.
No, I think we're genuinely very proud of each other. Like when somebody achieves something, We're just so pleased for them that it's happened for them, and especially somebody who, you know, we all have ups and downs in our career, and because we are friendly with one another, we sort of talk about the downs as well as the ups. So you don't get that thing of someone just telling you about all the good things yeah. that are happening to them. We sort of share the soft stories and the sad things and the upsetting things, and we all really depend on one another. So I think that's why you can just be so happy for people when things go right.
Because it's a brutal industry at the best of times. And I think that is that openness about it that makes it, especially when you are working solo a lot of the time as a writer and you don't have colleagues as such around the office to talk to, it must mean all that much more to have peers that you can share those moments with.
I mean, so much. Like, I think when you're on your own, you just, and authors are really imaginative people, of course,
yes.
but you just fill that silence with the worst possible interpretation of anything that's happening, you know, an email that you have from your editor. Sometimes you just need someone to say, I don't think that's that bad, when you're crying into your gourmet. So it's really useful just to be able to talk and to share these things. And with no ego, which is really amazing. Like
yes.
I honestly, I can only think of maybe one or two authors who are quite sort of on their dignity about it. But, you know, I remember at my first Harrogate meeting Lee Child and just being completely starstruck. And he talked to me like I was his equal. And it was just after my first book had come out. You know, I was very new, very green, didn't really know what I was doing. And he was so kind, and I've never forgotten it. But
wow.
It was just that really lovely sort of, I'm interested in you because you're another writer. And the fact that I'm Lee Child doesn't matter. So wow. it was a really special moment.
Wow, that is amazing. And you now get to do that for up and coming authors as well. And you're very, as you know, on social media, you're always sharing other people's books and, you know, engaging with the community. And I think that you're going to have that moment. You're going to give that moment to up and coming new authors now as well. So what a lovely full circle moment for you.
It really is. I mean, I guess you learn from the people around you. And I suppose it meant so much to me on that occasion to sort of have his warmth and kindness. And so, yeah, I mean, the last time, last year at Harrogate, I met some amazing debut authors who are being published now. And I suppose it's the ex-editor in me. I just get so excited for them. I know that amazing things are coming for them. And I know how daunting it is, having been there myself, to sort of be looking at your debut coming out. So I kind of try and bring a little bit of knowledge to them and experience and sort of share words of wisdom if I can.
I'm sure it's greatly appreciated. And I wonder, you know, talking about when you first published to now, you know, 12 crime novels down the line, how do you still have that feeling of nerves and excitement when you publish a new book, or has it changed as you've gone on throughout your career?
I mean, I definitely still worry. I mean, I think every single author worries when a new book is coming out, and the first reader's reactions are so important. And You kind of hope that people will understand what you were trying to do, and that they'll like what you've, the direction you've taken the characters. And with the latest in the Maeve Kerrigan series, that, I mean, I don't want to spoil anything, but there's an element of it that's, I think, going to be a little bit controversial. And so the first reactions from people have been really interesting and heartening, actually, quite nice.
I was going to say, I always do a little scour of Goodreads before I speak to an author. Just, you know, it can be a very dark and unpleasant place at times, but not on your books, I have to say, of incredibly positive response.
That amazes me, because, I mean, I have to say, I don't go to Goodreads. I sort of feel that is very much for readers, and I'm really happy for people to be able to talk among themselves. And I just feel, if I look at it, I might just burst into flames or something.
Just burn your house down. And yeah, that's not ideal. But yeah. I, not that I'm saying that you should look, because it's, I understand. And I personally would only focus on any, there are no negative things that I saw, but you would always be looking for negatives. But overwhelmingly, I have to say, very positive. The love that people have for Maeve is unbelievable. That's an incredible character that you've built that's transcended time, and just people are obsessed and love her so much.
I think, I mean, I'm really lucky that I've been able to write her for so long, and that, you know, I'm working on the 12th book in the series at the moment. So,
wow.
You know, I've had all that time to kind of develop her as a character and to let her speak. And because the books are from her perspective, I think people feel really close to her.
Yeah.
And that they have a real bond with her. And she just feels quite real. Like, to me, she feels like a somebody that I know. And I guess that comes across in the books. So people have this relationship with her that is nothing to do with me as a writer. It's sort of like I'm kind of in the middle, but they really understand her in their own way.
Well, that definitely. I mean, I was reading one of the reviews and then there was kind of comments on the one of the reviews on there. And they are talking about the characters like they know them. They're like, oh, well, we know that, you know, Maeve and Georgia are friends now and all this kind of thing. Like, they're talking about them, like they're gossiping about their close group of friends. And that is a testament to a really strong, relatable character.
I hope. I mean, yeah, I think that is something that has been really important for me is making her feel like a person and then seeing how people respond to her and to the other characters and making sure that she's kind of surrounded by real feeling people as well. Yeah. You know, the whole sort of group of them that investigate them, the regular series characters, I want them to feel sort of well-rounded and not just, you know, somebody who comes in and says something and goes out again. And it's really a joy to be able to kind of fill in those little blanks around the edges by writing some of the short stories and some, you know, just some extras that you just kind of color in the details a little bit. And I just think the readers really appreciate that.
Absolutely. Especially, obviously, you're writing the 12th one in the series. Like, it would, if you were just focusing on the one character and the whole time, it could probably get stale quite quickly, I imagine. So to build the world up is what gives it the richness and keeps the story moving forward.
Yeah, and like one of the things that I really appreciate about the readers is that they very often will go back and read the entire series in the run-up to a new book coming out. So, and, you know, I get messages from them on Twitter or Instagram, and they sort of say, I'm reading this book that came out 6 years ago, and I noticed this in it, and I'm following it through, and I can see what you've done, and I'm thinking, wow, did I really do that 6 years ago? That's amazing. What foresight. But they genuinely do seem to, you know, feel like they're real and feel like they want to know what's happened. And I have sort of the same feeling myself. Like, every time I start writing a Maeve book, my immediate thought is, what's happening with her? You know, how is she? Like, you want to catch up with her like she's an old friend that you haven't seen for a while.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. The relationships between them as well are, you know, there's so much kind of going on that keeps it not just about the crime even, because the crime part is obviously, you are a masterful writer of suspense, but just the interpersonal relationships between the characters also keeps you invested and keeps you engaged with them.
Are we talking about sexual tension here?
Maybe a little bit. We're after hours. We're almost, actually, no, we're not near the watershed, but, you know, sexy enough. We can get a bit sexy. Yes. How is that, writing the sexual tension?
I mean, like, I'm kind of horrified by how easily it comes to me. I just love writing scenes between Maeve and Josh. Oof. They are so much fun to write, the way that they banter, the kind of the relationship. And I think, again, because it's from Maeve's perspective, like, her view of him has changed so much over the course of the series. And so, you know, you kind of pick up on these little details that she misses. Sometimes the readers will hear something that he says differently than she hears it. And so it's kind of there's two things going on all the time. And I think that's just really fun to write, to kind of drop in those little clues about how he feels about things.
And fun to read as well. So everybody wins.
And yeah, I don't tend to write from his point of view. I kind of keep him separate, and I've never written a story or anything that is sort of his perspective directly. But I think that would be really interesting to know what's actually going on there.
I was going to say, was that something you'd consider in the future?
I mean, never say never. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I quite like him being mysterious as well.
I think that adds to the sexiness as well, to be honest.
I mean, this is it. Like, he just is a sexy character.
Yeah.
And I don't really know. I actually really didn't set out to write him that way. in the first book that he's in, he's not in the first book in the series. He's not in The Burning. He turns up in the second book, which is called The Reckoning. And he was supposed to be in that book and then never appear again. That was my plan for him. I remember writing him and thinking, why am I giving so much detail about this person who is going to disappear at the end of this book and be gone for good? And then the third book in the series is called The Last Girl, and I started writing that, and it begins with Maeve in a car. And as I was writing it, I realized he was driving the car and he had just returned. He wasn't going to be got rid of. And so he just became more and more important to Maeve, to me, to the series. And that all happened in a very organic way.
Wow. I find it so fascinating when characters become real like that. And you, even you don't know what they're going to do next.
No, I mean, it makes us sound absolutely insane. And I completely accept that. I know it sounds demented to say, well, he turned up and I wasn't expecting him to be there. But that is genuinely what happened. And I think part of the joy of writing is that you give yourself that room to kind of let things happen. So, you know, you plan things out, or you don't. Some people don't plan, but I plan. But I'm always kind of open to the possibility that a better thought will come along, and to follow that where it takes me. And he was a good thought.
Very good thought. And I guess that's how it leaves room for the creativity and the possibility for more. And I imagine as well, when writing a series, you plan a certain amount in advance as well, for maybe however many books you're writing ahead. How far ahead have you planned Maeve's journey?
I usually have about two or three books waiting to be written.
Wow.
That's kind of how I operate. And I kind of, in my head, I swap between them and think about them. And I do a huge amount of thinking before I ever write anything down. It's a really slow process. Once I start writing things, it's kind of a different phase of the creativity. But like initially, I just like to think about them and let them kind of play through my mind. And once I feel it's a book, then I move on to kind of notebooks and planning properly. So there are certainly plot lines that are running over kind of a couple of books into the future. People have started getting really nervous about whether I'm going to end the series. And I keep seeing this coming up and people saying, well, I think she's going to stop writing it after this one or the next one. But no plans. I certainly intend to keep writing them. I just, you know, I'd miss them too much.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. I think you look at, you know, in the past, like Arthur Conan Doyle could not wait to get rid of Sherlock Holmes and had to bring him back. And even Agatha Christie got so sick of some of her characters, but you're not sick of your characters, which is lovely to hear.
No, I mean, absolutely. I think with Agatha Christie, it was control.
Yes. Like
she wanted to be the person who decided what happened to them. And there is an element of that. Like when I'm working on a new book, there's always a point where I feel this is such a crime writer's thought, but I feel like if I was run over by a bus, then somebody else could finish it from this point and it would be a satisfying book. And I have a couple of authors in mind who I would ask to finish.
Ooh.
You know, I've sort of sounded them out already and they seem keen. You know, they would finish off something for me if something happened.
Okay, but
to
stay
me.
Away from buses for a while though, because we don't want that to happen anytime soon or ever.
But it is just that thing of, you know, I want to tell this story and sometimes I will write bits out of sequence just so that I know they're kind of banked, so that if for some reason I couldn't write it, at least I would have written those bits.
Wow. I have to say, it sounds like a weird thing to say, your brain is fascinating to me. That you, not only the jumping between kind of the narrative structure, like linear, and not, obviously jumping around in timelines, but the way you can have three books in your head at one time, that it takes an incredible amount of organization and compartmentalization, I imagine.
I mean, it's a bit weird. Like, I don't think there are many
it's impressive.
Work that way.
It's very impressive. It's not weird. I imagine people would be jealous of that skill. That's an incredible skill to have.
Well, it can be really frustrating. Like, there's definitely books that I would love to write that I know I'll never write because I just don't have time. It doesn't fit in with, you know, my general trajectory. It's not what people would expect from me. So I just have a really fun time just thinking about them. And that's kind of how I relax is thinking about these books that I'm never going to write and kind of writing them in my head.
Wow. That's a very impressive creative brain you have going there. It's quite something. I would love you to write all of the books you have in your head down though, because I want to read all of them. So you could do that.
There's lots of people who want me to write a Regency romance.
Ooh.
And I really love reading them. I've always really enjoyed them. I love Georgette Heyer. I have a massive romantic streak. I love writing romance, as you can tell from
yes.
the Maeve book. But I just can't see it. I don't think I could take it seriously.
You have to get a murder in there somewhere at least, right?
Well, I always end up killing someone. The thing. Like, even if I set out to write something really cozy, just death immediately happens.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a part of life. It's a very important part of life. Has it always been crime for you? Was that always your interest as a writer, even when you began? Obviously, you started with crime, but was that always the goal of getting to crime?
It took me a long time to realize that I should write a crime novel. And that sounds so stupid now. But like, I was a huge crime reader always. I think, like, I remember reading Agatha Christie when I was about 8 or 9. My parents were incredibly indulgent about books. So if there was something that we wanted to read, then that was fine. They never sort of said, is that suitable? Though looking back on it, perhaps they should. Because I do remember reading Thomas Harris. I remember reading Red Dragon when I was about 12. A really, like,
that's a dull read.
Thriller.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it all fits together with why I am the way I am. But it was a very shocking book. And I remember reading it, and there was one line in it that made me physically jump when I was reading. And the first thing I thought after I had kind of, after my heart rate had returned to normal, was, I wish I could do that. I wish I could write something that made people actually jump when they read it.
Do you remember the line?
It's a really straightforward thing. It's near the end of the book, and the hero's girlfriend is running through some sand dunes, and she runs up a sand dune and she looks straight into the killer's eyes. But you don't have, there's no point where you think that he's there until she's suddenly face to face with him.
And you face him at the same time as her in that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way that it's so simple, the way that it's done, but it's such a kind of moment. So, yeah. I that was a really kind of important moment for me. And then I went off to university, and I didn't kind of think that I was going to write anything other than maybe literary fiction or something like that. You know, even though I didn't really enjoy reading it that much, I was very much in that sort of like, oh, well, it has to be worthy, has to be good.
Yeah.
While still thoroughly enjoying reading crime all the time. And then I suppose it was when I was commuting to work and I was on the train, and murderous thoughts came very easily to me.
Yes. And I understand.
I found myself thinking about the what became my first book, The Missing. It was all written in my head while I was commuting and hating people.
It's very, yeah, I think we've all been there. It's a very relatable feeling to go through, but you've done it with a more productive, less fatal and illegal route, which is commendable, I have to say.
Thank you.
For not actually killing anyone.
It was the right choice, I think, not murdering people and doing it just through my laptop instead.
Yeah, although that could have been another way for you to meet your husband, I suppose, if he's a criminal barrister. You never know, it could have come in handy. But
he would absolutely, and I guarantee this, would have been prosecuting me. So I'm not sure it would have been the best way for us to meet.
You've definitely gone the right route then. That's good. With a series as long-running as your Maeve Kerrigan one, as you said, a lot of readers go back and read from the beginning, but what would you say that somebody, and I have my opinion on this, could come into this book without having read all of them in the series? I think yes, but is there anything you want people to take into this book if they haven't read the whole series, or anything that they should know, or do you like them to go in cold and figure it out as they go?
Like, I always read out of sequence, so I'm terrible at reading all the way through from the beginning. I think probably because I know now what it's like to write a series. I know that the best books start when you're sort of maybe 4 or 5 books in, and that's the point where you can really see how a series is going to develop. So I always write for readers like me. So I want people to be able to come in and just start reading and immediately feel, I know these people and I want to know more about them. And why is this going on like this? And enough is explained, I think, within the book for people to be able to follow it. But, you know, there's nothing that's kind of spoiled. Like, if you go back and read the previous books, you're not going to be like, oh, I kind of knew this was coming, or, oh, now I understand why we've ended up here. It should all be very still as fresh and exciting as, you know, if you were reading it through from the very beginning.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think you've achieved that perfectly. But there is also a skill in starting, you know, having these long running characters that a lot of your readers know and love intimately from going on the whole journey, but then also making it so somebody can come in just at the end point, but not be just have exposition shoved down their throats that they have to get all this background information before any of it makes sense. How do you balance that kind of seeding of enough information versus, you know, staying true to the characters that people know and love so well?
There's two necessary evils in writing crime. One is exposition and the other is research. And I just try and put as little of both on the page as possible. That's like my mission is, you know, I have to know all this stuff, but does it really help you to know it? Not necessarily. So a lot of it is just kind of hinting rather than saying what's going on. Because I think, you know, I've had that experience of reading a novel in a series and thinking, yes, yes, I don't need to read the next four paragraphs because they're just running through all the things that have happened before. So I never want people to have that feeling. I want them to be entertained by how it's talked about, even if they kind of know what is being hinted at or if they don't.
Yeah, no, and mission accomplished, I would say definitely. And I'm really curious with your writing process and the fact that you've written this long-running series, but you've also written standalones as well. Is there a big difference in the process across those two?
I find standalones terrifying. I think just because you just don't have that kind of rhythm that you're so used to and sort of the structure is different. And I find them much, much harder. People who write standalones all the time amaze me. Like the fact that you can go in and meet these new characters and introduce them and deal with them and then say goodbye to them and never want to go back and find out how they're going. It's a very different sort of way of thinking about telling a story, but I enjoy it. Like I do. It's just more of a challenge at this stage to write a standalone.
Yeah. Okay. So the process is slightly different then if you're coming in completely cold with new characters, obviously, versus the balancing of your existing characters that you know so well, but keeping it fresh for people coming in as a first read, say.
I mean, I think with a standalone, you're kind of more about the story than the characters. I think that has to be your kind of, you have to have a really strong hook for a story, and it has to be something that's self-contained that you can get to an ending with it. Whereas with a series, you can kind of, you can nudge things over into the next book. You can kind of, it's more like a river that kind of flows along and has different phases as you go along.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And with the writing process, a question I like to ask all the authors I speak to is, what do you enjoy most and least about it?
I mean, what I enjoy most is that lovely moment when you're thinking about it and it's perfect. And, you know, that this is going to be the most amazing book ever because you haven't written a word of it down. And at the moment, it's still this lovely, lovely idea in your mind. That's, you know, daydreaming. Like, who wouldn't love that? That is my favorite part of the job. And then my least favorite part is probably when you are about halfway through and you are fully committed. You don't have time to write something else. You really have to, you know, you've nailed your cutout to the mast. The story is what the story is. The characters are where they are. And you have doubt. And yeah. I think it's really common. Like I've talked to so many writers about this. I know Ian Rankin has said he gets to the 30,000 word mark.
Wow.
And immediately panics. Like it's just such a common thing. But it's this horrible moment where you suddenly question everything that you've done up to that point. And you just have to push on through. And, you know, it's not a performance. You can always go back and fix things. You can always rewrite the beginning. I've done that probably on half the books. They have a completely different opening than I originally planned and wrote. Just, you know, you have to get to the end to know what the book is. And so it's just all about keeping going at that point and having faith in yourself and knowing you can go back and change things when you finally have time to.
It's so fascinating to hear, you know, you've written a huge number of books, and like someone like Ian Rankin has written a huge number of very successful books. So hear that even you still have doubts at this point in yourself is very, you know, I imagine for upcoming writers who have those doubts, it must be incredibly comforting to hear that not comforting because it doesn't go away. That's not comforting, but knowing that they're not alone in that feeling and that that's perfectly normal for that point in the process.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. I think if you're not questioning yourself, you're probably writing a really terrible book.
Yeah.
It's part of making it good is to test yourself constantly and say, you know, are my plans right? Did I think of this the right way? Is this really boring? I mean, I bore myself sometimes. Like I'm writing and I think this is so tedious, but it's actually just, you know, I need to have a biscuit or something. It's not the book. It's me. And that's, you know, learning that this is part of you, the way that you'll feel about it is, you know, that's the experience that helps. But there is that always that like thump of disappointment when you get to that point and you think, oh, I didn't think it was going to happen this time. But yeah, I mean, I have literally said to my agent before, I think I've written the wrong book. And she's a very chilled out person. She said, that is a new one for me. I haven't had that before from a client, but okay, let's talk about it.
There you go. At least you're original with your doubt and your concerns. That's nice to hear.
Yeah, and that was the killing kind. It was I had a real wobble about it, and that it was too complicated. It's a book about a stalker, and I said I should have started in a different place. And in the end, I was convinced that no, it was fine. It was fine as it was.
And it was fine because it was a Richard and Judy book club pick. So it must have been pretty good in the end.
I mean, I would say authors are the worst people to judge their work.
Yes. Well, on that note, actually, a new question I've started asking people is, what's a line that you've written either lately or across your catalogue that you're especially proud of?
There's a line in The Cutting Place. Actually, it's a bit of dialogue. And I really love it. It's from quite far into the book. And it's Maeve talking to Josh. And she says to him, he's just chased after a suspect and he's wearing like a stab vest and it's a hot summer evening. And he comes back and he's very hot and sweaty. And she says to him, you look as if you need to take off some clothes. He says, yes, yours.
Nice.
It's such a great, the reason I love it is it, to me, that just says everything about their relationship. First of all, it's a really like funny moment between them. And then it has consequences further on in the book. So it's doing so much work, that little kind of two lines. It is just such a, I was really pleased when I read that. I felt like I've done something there. That's a good turning point for the book. And people won't even know it when they read that. But actually, that's a key moment.
And that is incredibly powerful. It's a short sentence, because simple words, but incredibly meaningful. And yeah, wow. That's a great choice and a very sexy moment as well. That's a bit of a sexy theme going on here. I like it.
There he is. He's a little sweaty. No, he needs to take off his clothes.
Is it hot in here or is it just Josh? It's hard to say.
Actually, when people sometimes ask me who would play him if it was televised. And I just always say, like, the sexiest actor you can think of, that's who it should be. Because it's so different for everybody. Like, people have a very different image of him in their head, depending on what they find attractive. So yeah.
That's a good way of thinking. Do you have one in your head? You don't have to tell me who, but do you write with a particular visage in mind?
Not so much. I mean, I think like kind of young Harrison Ford is
that's a pretty good one.
Accessible at this point. But yeah, that kind of like, that's how I think of him. But yeah, not a specific actor.
They can do anything with CGI these days. They can make him young again. They did it in Star Wars. They could do it for you. So
great. Well, there we go. That's settled.
There we go. Fixed it. There we go. Nice one. When everyone's ready to make it, we've got it in the bag. And speaking of your wonderful characters, and not just in this series, across your standalones and things as well, another question I like to ask is, if you had to be a character from one of your books, who would you be and why?
I would like to be Georgia Shaw, who is Maeve's colleague. She's a detective constable. She's a walking disaster in terms of her professional life and skills. But she has this really sweet nature, and she's really confident. Nothing ever knocks her confidence in herself. And I just love that. I mean, that's so different from me. She's a really fun character to write. And I love everything about her, basically. But the fact that she's incompetent, like very often I feel incompetent. So I feel like a very strong bond with her. I think I would be Georgia.
Now, that's a great choice as well. Because I think a lot of people would assume you'd pick Maeve, given your, you know, how long you've been writing her and everything you've been through. But I like that as an off-piste choice. Why not Maeve for you?
I mean, I think her job is just so scary. Like, I would be so bad at it. And I sort of feel she's lots of things that I admire. And she is so, like, I kind of hero worship her a little bit. She always comes up with the right thing to say in any situation. She's very brave. She's very principled. She is really likable in many ways. But yeah, I don't think I could fit myself into that framework. Like, I just don't feel I could live up to her.
And it's so interesting because obviously you write her. So you've got to think you've got some of that in you somewhere.
I'll tell you one thing that is absolutely from life, and that's the fact that she is so bad at cooking. I am so bad at cooking. I cannot tell you. And I find it so boring. And, you know, there are some authors who write characters who cook amazing meals, and that's how they relax. And I feel that is coming straight from their own lives. But like Maeve is like, ugh, toast, that'll do.
She's too busy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, understandable.
And, that is me.
Okay. Well, there you go. There's always, do you think that you have to put something of yourself into a character when you're writing them?
I guess all characters come from somewhere within you, even the kind of evil ones. So, yeah, like, you know, you are creating them ultimately. And they have to, I feel it's really important to have empathy with them, even the kind of monstrous ones, that you sort of write them with understanding rather than judgment, because you can always tell when an author is kind of sitting back and going, you know, you're really going to hate this person, they're so awful. I like it to be a bit more kind of nuanced than that, you know, that you could maybe see why they are the way they are.
Yeah, it's more realistic, because nobody's ever just a villain really in real life, apart from like Putin. But that's quite unusual, you know, like most people, as you say, there's a reason why, or there's more, they're multifaceted. People are multifaceted. So no one's all bad or all good.
No, I mean, there are grey characters who are all bad.
Yeah.
And like Hannibal Lecter, let's say, you know.
But he's funny.
Exactly. Yeah. He's charming.
Yeah.
And I think Thomas Harris really liked him.
Yeah.
That's my reading, that he really enjoyed writing him and really liked him.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And speaking of reading, you're a very busy woman. Do you have much time for reading?
Read a lot of proofs. So, you know, authors get sent so many books to read and quote. And I really like to support other writers, as you know, we discussed.
Yes.
And that's a huge thing for me, is kind of keeping up with what other people are writing and saying nice things about them. But it leaves so little time for reading anything else.
Yeah.
And also, I'm always like a year ahead of everyone. So people say, what should I read? And I'm like, oh, well, next year you should read this book, which is amazing. But it is quite hard to fit everything in.
I mean, I even find it, I can only imagine how you must with the amount you must quote for and things like that and blurb for too. But what was the last book that you read and loved?
Actually, it's one that is available now.
Oh.
So I feel quite pleased with myself.
Very current.
I read Joe Callahan's book In the Blink of an Eye.
Yeah.
Which is a very clever police procedural with a detective paired up with an AI detective sort of hologram. And it's really clever and it's really lovely. And she just writes with such heart, and it's her debut, but it's an incredibly accomplished book. So I really enjoyed that.
That's a great pick. And I've read that one as well. And I met Jo at Capital Crime this year. She's, you know, it's amazing to see a book about AI, as you're saying, having heart, because it's so easy to think robot, soulless, cold, but there's that humanity that she brings to it that really makes it special.
Oh, absolutely. Like, he's a fantastic character.
Yeah.
Like, he's so rounded, and so there's something really moving about him. And that is such a testament to her skill. You know, she's really a fantastic writer.
Absolutely.
So it's really exciting that she's at the start of a series and we get so many more.
I know. Lucky us. Oh, Jane, it's been so lovely chatting to you this evening. And I feel so awful that I now have to confront you about a terrible crime you've committed. Yeah, I think you know what I'm talking about, Jane. You've committed a crime so terrible, so shocking, so heinous in nature that unfortunately you have now been sentenced to death.
Oh, I knew it would catch up with me one day.
What crime do you think you've committed to get to this point, if you knew this whole time?
I mean, I clearly murdered several people while commuting, just, you know, in the most vicious ways possible. But they deserved it.
I don't doubt it. You know, we've all commuted. We've all wanted to do the exact same thing. In a way, you're
no
a hero.
Guilt.
No, and in a way, you are like the people's princess. Like, that's, you know, the hero, not the hero. Was it not the hero we want, the hero we deserve? I think that's what we need more of. So I agree with it. I think it's great. Top marks, 10 out of 10, no notes for your killings. But unfortunately, the courts didn't agree with that stance. So Aurora, sentenced to death. Really, really sad. But the good news is I can get you the death row meal of your dreams. So it's not all bad. Worth it, in some might say. What would your death row meal be?
I mean, 100% it would be macaroni cheese.
Oh, because great one.
Carbs, right? Like, you're going to want to have some serious carbs. Cheese. Life isn't worth living without cheese.
Completely agree.
Obviously, you're kind of at the end of your life at this point, but, you know, why not celebrate it with a good cheesy pasta bowl full of yumminess?
It's the ultimate comfort food.
That's what I think.
Yeah, the perfect choice. Wow. What cheeses are going in the mac and cheese? Do you have a preference?
I mean, really strong cheddar.
Oh, yeah.
Really strong. I mean, anything. I'm a big cheese person. Yeah. I would take cheese over chocolate if that was ever a choice that was offered to me. It will always be cheese.
A big cheese. I respect that a lot. Do you have is it a homemade mac and cheese? Is it someone you know that makes it? Or is it a restaurant you like it from? Or
my mum used to make the most amazing one. She used to put a lot of chili in it.
Ooh.
So it was very, like, it kind of fought back a bit. but really, really lovely. So it would be like my mother's macaroni and cheese.
Okay, we'll get that. We'll get the chili in there. You need the chili to cut through the creaminess sometimes. That's a nice little extra. I like the way she thinks. Would you have a dessert as well, or is that enough for you?
I'm not a big dessert person.
Okay. A drink?
A nice red wine, I'd be happy.
Okay, we can do that for you. No problem. Okay, well, you've had your beautiful glass of wine and very cheesy mac and cheese. Unfortunately, you are now dead. I'm really sorry that you've died. But more good news. Good news. I will bury you with the book of your choice.
So what? Is it something to keep me going in the afterlife? Like something I can read again and again?
It's entirely open to interpretation. So what book would you be buried with?
It would be The Secret History by Donna Tartt.
Great book.
The crime writer's crime novel. I think like every single crime writer is a little bit obsessed with this book. And I read it when it came out and I was about 16. And again, it was one of those really, like, I remember reading it and just being so amazed by it. And I've read it so many times since then. And I actually got a writer friend of mine to read it last week. And she was messaging me as she was going along. And I was like, yeah, yeah, that is amazing. Yeah, yep. I love it too. Yeah. And
told you.
Quoting huge chunks of it to her. I think she was a bit scared by the end.
How many times have you read it, do you think?
Oh, I have no idea. Like 50?
Wow.
I mean, so many times. Like my copy of it looks like puff pastry now because it's so completely, like, all the pages are brown and turning up at the edges. I'm like, yeah, it's a very special book.
Yeah, it is an incredible book. And I don't think I've ever met anyone that doesn't like it, because it's just, it's a perfect book, isn't it? In so many ways.
There are a couple of holdouts. There are a couple of people I know
who
have been critical. And I think less of them for it.
Correct. Yeah, no, they're probably just jealous, surely. I mean,
yes, definitely.
Yeah.
But even Donna Tartt couldn't write a second one. So, you know, she went her different direction and that's fine.
Yeah.
She's written very good books since then, but there's only one Secret History.
Isn't it? I think last year, was it the 30th anniversary of Secret History? Like, and the fact that it's still talked about so passionately today, that is an incredible achievement, isn't it?
It's a proper classic.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Oh, Jane, I've had such a wonderful time chatting to you this evening. Thank you so much for speaking to me.
It's an absolute pleasure. I mean, what a joy to get to talk about crime writing for an hour. Been lovely.
Well, the pleasure has truly been all mine. Where can people follow you online for more of this gold that you give?
I mean, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram, I'm on Facebook. It's all Jane Casey Author. That will find me everywhere. And I'm there a little bit too much of my time.
Oh, I can relate to that. But thank you again. It's been so lovely chatting to you. You have the most comforting, soothing voice as well. I feel very relaxed and happy from this chat. So thank you.
It's basically ASMR at this point.
Like, yes. You've got do you do that? Because you should do that. You could make some side money with that. That would be a nice little pocket money for you.
Be better than feed pics. So,
well, yeah,
another, you know, backup plan if the writing goes sideways.
It's always good to have a backup plan.
You've got to have a backup plan. Feet themed, you know.
It's hard to get a foot in the door, though, isn't it?
I'm glad you said it.
Thank you. Jane, thank you so much. And thank you all for listening. I'll be back soon with another episode. And the other thing, Jane, is I never know how to end this podcast. I'm terrible at it. How shall we end this conversation?
Oh, my goodness. I don't even know. We just need to... just trying to think if we talked about anything that was... that we could call back to. But I don't think we have, really.
No.
We need to do some ASMR noises.
Oh, that would be great. Like, we can do some, like...
I'll do it.
That'll do it. Thank you.
How would you like to challenge your little grey cells while revelling in the vintage perfection of David Suchet's Poirot?
If so, then the Labours of a Hercule podcast was made for you.
We're taking a deep dive into every episode of this masterpiece of television and giving you the clues you need to solve the case along with Poirot himself.
We present the case and you solve it.
Whether you're a detective in the making,
or if you just simply want to gush over the genius and art decadence of Agatha Christie,
then subscribe now to the Labours of Hercule wherever you get your podcasts.